The flight path of true love never runs smooth. Donna's excitement at entering the enrollment program is soon tempered when she goes on a date with Ted. Interestingly, they choose to go to a restaurant. One of the excellent things about a film in which the main stars are seated so frequently is that you aren't distracted by a lot of scenery whizzing past in the background. You can just zero in on their faces and set about trying to work out what's whirring within. Ted kicks off proceedings by raising a toast and congratulating Donna on her admittance to the Royalty Airlines training program. One thing strikes the audience member immediately. Ted is raising a rather large glass of water, with which he chinks Donna's glass of red. Is Ted teetotal? Is he in recovery? Have there been troubled waters over which he's had to do a little bridge work? Also, Ted's drunk a good deal of the water in that massive glass. What kind of bladder does a man have? It's no good squirming while getting the download from Donna about her feelings / resentment / petty beefs about work colleagues, etc., as it might make him look less scintillated. Donna confesses to being nervous, that many people don't get past the first 2 weeks and that she doesn't want to be among their number. Graciously, Ted contends that she will have no problems whatsoever. She is smart, beautiful, and charming. Part of the job of female protagonist is to choose which supporting male to allow into your character's private thicket. And one way you can always tell whether a chap's the ticket is if he compliments you on your intelligence before your looks. Here's a man who knows you've got the juice, but isn't going to bang on about what an absolute knockout you are before giving a tip of his hat to your glorious grey matter. Sure, you're a 10, a dime, a babe. But the first thing that struck our man when he saw you in that tight dress as you walked toward him in slow motion, while the camera tilted up from your high heels, fully taking in any movement that happened to occur twixt hips and hair flick, was that tremendous brain of yours. There, he said to himself, is a bonce for the ages. This woman's an all-round intellect. I can't fault her spatial perception, and she seems strong linguistically, kinesthetically, and administratively. No wonder the supporting male looked so flustered. He hadn't seen someone so mentally on top of things since he can't remember when, and it's only at that point that he stops and thinks, hang on, the surface elements aren't too shabby either. Ted plays a straight bat, keeps his wits, and lobs in another generic compliment. Charming, so it doesn't look like he's some kind of demented sociopath bifurcating all and sundry into brains and brawn. This is not to dismiss the importance of looks. It's very important to be good-looking, if only because the alternative is to be bad-looking. You can't really expect any half-decent dude to have, let alone hold, a dog's dinner. That's just the law of the jungle. If your face is neither fish nor fowl, but rather a mixture of the two, then the male gaze may not alight. Best to stay behind closed doors and secure the chub lock. Take Mike Myers' John Whitney. One of his eyes points the wrong way. It's funny, fiendishly so, but is it romantic? Clearly not. The idea of Mike Myers' John Whitney finding love is farcical. He could no more be a romantic lead than a tube of pate or a turd. Shallow Hal, an other standout Paltrow vehicle, addresses this with eloquence. There's often something, well, sneaky about ugly people. Some have a squint, or one leg shorter than the other, or a stoop, or a thatched neck, or teeth that don't seem to be playing on the same team, and the whole effect is one of making you wonder where you are with them. Whereas when faced with something smooth, symmetrical, and clean, one gets a distinct whiff of the divine, a celestial scent that lets you know God's done his work and all is well. Donna knows an orator when she sees one, and she says as much, commending Ted on one hell of a pep talk, even though it was more of a pep sentence. But the woman looks as sparkling as a freshly scrubbed pan, and we're ready to forgive any vagaries. How much harder it is to take such imprecision from the fouler face. It makes you realise the true value of movie stars. At the time of going to print, Robert Downey Jr. has earned $50 million and climbing for Iron Man 3. You may think this outrageous, but just take a look in the mirror. Do you want a permanent record of the disappointment? Do you want to exhibit footage of your ranted reflection? For additional complexity, try talking fast while smirking. We see here a simple principle of the market. When demand equals the entire planet and supply equals one, Downey Jr., you can dictate your own checks. Ted bats away the compliment, sweeping away any praise for his eloquence into the path of his parents, whom he describes as big cheerleaders. Ted has a wonderfully suggestive way of painting pictures with words, doesn't he? No point saying how great I am, Donna. It's all nurture. Cosseted and cooed, cheeks pink from pinching, puffed up with hot air, smothered in soothing oil, here lies a stranger to opprobrium. But Ted's attestation robs him of agency. My ability to give on-the-spot exhortation is not down to my native gifts, he implies, with an angled tilt of the head, his mouth chewing a restrained bite of movie food. It was given to me, imparted, if you will, by my parents. But Donna's mom was an ex-showgirl. Her uncredited dad went to children's parties exclusively to drink beer. What chance did Donna have? No off-the-cuff speeches for her. She lacks the breeding. When you start to unpack the statement, it starts to feel incredibly insulting. What looks like modesty is actually a quasi-fascist argument either for genetic supremacy or the absolute necessity of being correctly encoded within a family unit. It's a far-right conservative's charter. One infant bathed in balm, the other forced to endure the incessant gustiness of Nevada, unable to light so much as a birthday candle without it fatally guttering. In such cirques, a girl doesn't even have the strength to hold on to her balloon. Let it fly, she thinks. I don't know how much longer I can stand the strain. Donna, squashing down her envy, quotes Sally as saying that the greatest asset you can have is someone who believes in you. Two things strike the viewer. Firstly, he or she wonders whether there is a danger in turning human relationships into assets. Secondly, he or she asks him or herself, why is Donna talking as if Ted will know who the hell Sally is? Ted, reading our minds, asks if Sally is like her aunt or something. Donna says that Sally's more of a friend. This is one of the few exchanges in the film where we wonder whether Donna is one pickle short of a Plowman's. Is she constructing an elaborate fantasy in which Sally Weston, a woman whom she's never met, is already her friend? Let's recap the scene. Curtain up. 1. Donna nervous about flight attendant training. 2. Ted convinced she'll be great. 3. Donna impressed by Ted's exhortation. 4. Ted cites the importance of parental support. 5. Donna quotes Sally Weston's wisdom. Fini. As they exit Lulu's, French cuisine, it's almost clear from Donna's facial expressions that she's enjoyed her time with Ted. She casually mentions that she's having a goodbye party. Ted declines the offer, saying that he would be unable to hide his disappointment that she is leaving so soon. It sounds sweet, but there's an ominous undercurrent. Unable to celebrate the success of others, Ted knows that he would spend the evening brooding in the corner, stewing at each interaction which did not involve him, furious that his will had been thwarted. Inexplicably aroused by his petulance, Donna begins to lean into him, a glazed expression in her eyes. Ted pivots to be at even more of an angle. Ruffalo, an ex-high school wrestler, often looks to be readying himself to receive a blow. But when their faces are little less than 12 inches apart, Ted stops himself. Is it Donna's wine-soaked breath? An old wrestling injury? His stated reason is that the only kiss we've got here is a goodbye kiss, which, as kisses go, are not my favourite. But couldn't he have worked this out when he was at a decent distance from the woman? And why is he creating this bizarre taxonomy of kisses? One fears Ted notes each oral interaction in his little snog log and grades them for firmness, moistness, and ferocity. Dear Snoglog, today was a bad day. I was hoping for I'm staying in Cleveland tongue, but I had to keep it in the cave. Donna's training program is in Texas, so that's where Donna's going to go. If you want to reach the top and thence view, you go to Texas and you train like hell and you shut up about what kind of kisses you like. Perhaps Donna needed some physical release before she knuckled down. Maybe she wanted the oblivion of consequence-free Congress, or is Ted unable to give her even that? Earlier, we talked about the parable of the unjust steward. Has Ted Stewart been unjust here? Should he have aped Tommy Boulay and given Donna the gift of his girth? At the end of the parable, Jesus warns, "No man can serve two masters." And if we were to imagine that he was talking about women as well as men, this could well apply to Donna Jensen. Can she serve her ambition and romance? Another well-placed VO allows her to deepen the dilemma of free will. Why can't all choices be simple? Window or aisle? Coffee or tea? Not career or romance. In short, why can't life be idiomatically similar to air travel? Yet for me, window or aisle isn't a simple choice, and if I haven't checked in online, it's often not a choice at all. I like to look out of the window so I can be the first to see if a wing goes missing, but I also have a weak bladder and dislike hurtling over the prone. Is it too fanciful to think that if people had travelled by plane during the life of Christ, he might have used the language of aviation during his teachings? Perhaps he would have ended the parable of the unjust steward by saying, "No plane can have two pilots." But a Pharisee who wanted to trap Jesus said, "What about the co-pilot?" And Jesus said unto him, "The captain is the legal commander. The co-pilot only takes over if the captain has been incapacitated. That's basic." And another Pharisee, who was wise in the way of aviation law, though his heart was hard, replied, "But doesn't the co-pilot or first officer normally share control with the pilot, designating one as the PF or pilot flying, while the other is named the PNF or pilot not flying?" And Jesus, knowing they wished to trap him, said, "It doesn't matter who's flying the plane. The buck stops with the captain. He alone is responsible for the aircraft, its passengers, and its crew. Except in the case of incapacitation," said the Pharisee. "An incapacitated pilot is no longer able to pilot, so we're getting into ontology here," said Jesus. "But you will agree that there are two pilots," said another Pharisee. "There's a pilot and co-pilot. That's different to two pilots, and it's different to two co-pilots. Just as ant and ant is not the same as deck and deck, nor is deck without ant, ant and deck, but something other, and not the one true union, no matter how good Holly Willoughby might be," said Jesus. When the chief priests heard this, they were amazed, and not only because they wondered how long before the reference would date. And they phoned their uncle Levi and told him what Jesus had said, which took quite a while, because he said he didn't know who Holly Willoughby was, and they didn't believe him. As he and Donna part, the camera tracks into Ted, trapped in his puritanical bubble, while Donna paces off, no doubt to frig herself unconscious. The soundtrack swells to the sound of Time After Time, the song made famous by Cyndi Lauper. The cover by Katie Cook is so faithful that it's only on the level of your subconscious that you realize something's missing. This dissatisfaction cleverly mimics the thoughts that we might read into Ted's face if we weren't so angry with him. The undercarriage of the scene, though, refers back to the parable of the unjust steward. Can one serve one's work/career and family/relationships? We will discuss this at much greater depth in the Junus, of course. For now, it's a conflict so big that it needs its own musical motif.